radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and we have a great and exciting program for you talking about live fire training. And I've got some of the top trainers on the line with us today, and they're actually part of the author group for the new Jones and Bartlett program that will be coming out very shortly. Excited about that. But we'd like to remind you that Training and Tactics Talk is focused on getting the best training and education to our people in the field, the troops that are making the rubber meet the road and keeping them safe, because our goal is to give quality training so that everyone comes home. With us today, again, I'm your host, Douglas Klein. On the line with us is Dave Casey. He's a master in public administration, the deputy chief for the Seminole Tribe in Florida. He is the lead author for the new NFPA textbook on live fire training principles and practices being published through Jones and Bartlett. He's an executive fire officer graduate, and he spent 6 years with the Florida State Training group there as the director. So if you've never been to Florida and seen some of their training facilities, it's an awesome, awesome facilities that they have there. On with me also today is Susan Schell. She's 29 years in the emergency services, hailing from up around Maryland, a lot of time up there teaching at the Maryland Fire Rescue Institute, and currently she's at the Florida Bureau of Fire Standards and Training, and she's a training manager there, and she's located at the Ocala site. So we're glad to have Susan on board with us. Also on the group with us is Mike Kemp. Mike hails again also from Florida. So we got a Florida crew on, but he also participates highly in instruction. He's retired as a battalion chief out of Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. 32 years total experience, starting back in 72 as a volunteer and working his way up through the ranks, holding multiple positions. One of the ones that really sticks out in his key, and he's passionate about that, is his training. And he was a training officer there. Does a lot of instruction. These folks also sit on the Florida Task Force for live fire instructor and have been doing a lot of burning, a lot of education. And they recently joined me when we did an International Society of Fire Service Instructors certification program for live fire instructors. And we did that pilot program in Connecticut. And it's great to have all of us on board again, and especially the three of y'all bringing the expertise to the table about what we're going to talk about today, and that's live fire training. And we're going to focus in particularly on the Class A and Class B, or the gas-fired, non-gas-fired training props. So, guys, welcome on board.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's definitely an honor and a privilege to have worked with some of these folks very closely when we put together a program. And I'm going to start off by talking a little bit about what's really required. You know, we've had cases and we've talked about, you know, through the periods of time we've been doing training and tactics talk, how important training truly is. With this, the importance of having people trained and ready to go when they come to a live fire training exercise is just paramount. And there's areas that need to be addressed. Your student prerequisites are located initially under 1403 in the NFPA standard 1403 in Chapter 5. That's the first place they really show themselves big time. It relates it back to the NFPA 1001 standard for firefighter professional qualifications. The subjects that they address, there's 10 main subjects for gas-fired training structures, and that's safety, fire behavior, portable extinguishers, personal protective equipment, ladders, fire hose appliances and strings, overhaul, water supply, ventilation, and forcible entry. And those are important. As we go through here, I'm going to call upon Dave real quick just to talk about some of the importance that he feels that are wrapped around these student prerequisites.
Well, if you look historically back at some of the fires that have not gone well, you can directly see a correlation between the experience of the students entering into the training versus some of those that are just coming in. They're unprepared. They're not ready to go into the types of evolutions that they're being exposed to. And the standard's real clear what needs to be done ahead of time. And even beyond the standard, you have to really look at the situations you've got and what you're exposing them to make sure it's appropriate, one, for what training they've had. You don't want to put them into a gates of hell fire when it's their very first exposure to it. And two, you need to make sure that they're prepared for whatever contingencies come up. I mean, you've got your RIT, you've got your safety people, but those students need to be mentally geared up so that they're not just in a survival mode of being concerned about getting through the evolution. You want them to be actually learning from it.
That's definitely important, and I talk about it through education or training of instructors, the importance of what I call a stair-step approach, where students begin to build each time out their level of experience, their confidence, their abilities, getting them to what we want them to have is the effective level of learning. And I feel that that's super important, and I pick up on what you're saying there. Susan, let's kind of look at this approach a little bit since you're right there at the Training Academy in Florida, in Ocala. You're in charge over the Bureau of Standards and Training, so how do you feel about some of this and express your thoughts of what we're talking about here with students?
Well, and in charge of training here under the Bureau, we have a Bureau Director and I'm in charge of training. The fire PA behavior and the PPE is very, very important, especially with the students that are coming for that first burn. If they don't have an understanding, first of all, of what their equipment's going to do for them, that gives them the safety. And that also prepares them for what they're going to see. They know that they need to have equipment that fits. They know that that equipment, if it doesn't fit proper, if it's not going to meet NFPA standards, that they could be injured. So they've got to have that knowledge in advance, so they need that training, have been worked with, and have proper gear. And then on fire behavior, they need that before we put them into a burn building. We do not want them getting in. I strongly agree with both of you. You start from a lower level fire and you upgrade as the student progresses in their experience because we don't want them panicked. While the training is, we can control this factor, and this is the one area that we can control, and we should not be getting any students or instructors hurt during training. We can control it. That's why these prerequisites are there. It gives us that controlled environment. We know what the student's base level of knowledge coming in, and then we're building upon it as we do these burns. So in training, it's very, very important that these students have this before they show up to an acquired, in this case, in a Class A burn building in that facility, because you don't want to be retraining them, and that's going to cause the whole thing. If you can't come in and be confident in their basic level of skills, you cannot progress them. So that's why those standards are there as well, to give you a basic. The students are coming all in at one level, so now we can progress forward with them, and you can do it safely. And that's why they need all those prerequisites.
Okay, Mike, kind of jumping to you, being an instructor that does a lot of live fire training, especially at the facility you're at, Palm Beach State College. Let's ask you the question here, with you being at Palm State College, Palm Beach State College, and you're doing a lot of this training with your firefighters and with getting these students ready to burn. Talk about some of the techniques that you use to get students ready to burn and get them up to where you're comfortable taking them into this ideal H environment with fire, even though it's in a fixed facility.
And one of the things we really want to do is, you know, reiterate a little bit what Susan and Dave said, is fire behavior, understanding basic fire behavior and the phenomena that we call fire behavior. And then not so much in the Class A building, but, you know, when we do acquired structures, the building construction plays a big role. So fire behavior plays a really big role in a Class A building, understanding how the fire is going to develop, where is it going to go, the smoke, you know, how does that play into it. And if the students understand that, that plays a big role in how we feel on, are they capable of going into a Class A building, you know, and understanding their equipment. They have to understand that and how everything operates.
Well, that's real important, and I couldn't agree with you more there. Looking at either gas-fired or non-gas-fired, the prerequisites for students to be able to go into these buildings are the same. I want to talk a little bit about a problem that we have when it comes to student prerequisites. A lot of people, and I know that throughout the United States they're using this, they say if you've met these prerequisites for 1403, then you can actually begin fighting fire. Well, that is correct. You can't, but, and I use but very strongly here, that is in a training capacity. And a lot of folks are now jumping and using this standard and saying, oh, we can take them and put them in, you know, our department, and they're doing live fire operations on a scene. And that's not the case. The standards are very clear, and especially in NFP 1001, it talks about being completely qualified and going through all the prerequisites in NFPA 1001. 1403 references that 1001, but it talks about specific subjects just to be able to burn. So that's something I wanted to throw out there, because this has been a case in, you know, where we've had injuries, and, you know, that's not a good thing. That's not what we're after. So let's kind of clear the record there and make it, you know, real clear what NFPA is saying. The next thing we really, I think, need to look at is our instructors. And a lot of folks, you know, just love this ability to teach people. They enjoy being hooked up and really making differences in students' lives. And that's great. When it comes down to live fire training, and Dave, I'm going to jump to you on this one. The standard says the instructor is really picked by authority or designated by authority having jurisdiction. But we all know, the four of us know, that there's some importance about instructors. Let's talk about the importance of the instructor being qualified to conduct a live fire training incident.
Well, and that's just such a crucial item. If you look at 1403, and this isn't meant in disrespect or real criticism, but it doesn't say what is a 1403 instructor, other than the individual must be qualified by the authority having jurisdiction, and there's a reference back to at least having instructor one and, you know, your basics. Some states have gone beyond that. Florida and North Carolina are two that come to mind right away that have specific requirements to be a certified live fire trainer. And this is where the ISFSI course is going to really be a great value to departments that aren't under a state or provincial mandate for certain requirements for training and such like that for live fire trainers. So it's in theory possible that if the fire department says the person's qualified, then they're qualified to go forth and be one of the trainers. And we just know that that's a fallacy, that you need to have some sort of training process. People need to be experienced in what they're trying to teach, and those that are more qualified, following along with what forestry's done for years, you need to be trained, you need to be mentored, and you need to be observed and then qualified and credentialed to do the training. And you just see time and time again what the first chapter of the book goes over, how we got here. And if you look how we got here, it wasn't a pretty route, where people that were not qualified to do a lot of the training caused injuries and in some cases even fatalities.
Well, that's something that we know, is that each year in training across the United States, on an average, we have anywhere between 5 and 10 deaths a year in training. And we have researched that fairly extensively in the fire service and know that a lot of those are preventable. So to you, Susan, I know that you're responsible for people that come in there and teach, and you would be one of the ones that kind of coordinate some of these hirings. What are you looking for? What is the key components that you're looking for when you're hiring somebody that's going to be doing these live fire training evolutions and programs and you know, a lot of the training that is crucial to our firefighters?
Well, there's both experience and knowledge level. They've got to have training. They, if they're going to be doing live fire training, they have to be not only read 1403, but they have to have knowledge of it and be able to apply it. being able to read it and say, yeah, we need reports, but what are those reports? Who do you have to contact? What agencies? How do you do a check of someone's prerequisites? You can just read 1403, but you really have to be able to apply it. And you also have to bring in that experience knowledge level. If you have never done or participated in a live fire training burn, then how can you be an instructor of one? You've got to have that knowledge, and that's where Dave goes back into the mentoring and the ISFSI's program of mentoring instructors and giving them the paperwork and showing them some of the routes and this is how you need to do this and how to prep and prepare even in an acquired building, a live fire burn building. If it's a gas prop or a Class A with gas props, they have to be trained by the manufacturer to run those props. It just can't be someone run in and flip the switch. So that training is very important. So when I'm looking at personnel that are people that are going to be training, I look at their level of knowledge, their experience, and we, in fact, in Florida, put them through the 1403 training program that is very similar to ISFI's. And we do that mentoring with people. So those are things that we're looking at. It's very important that they have the experience and the knowledge together and that they've actually participated in live fire burns in order so that they can teach.
Okay, Mike, I'm going to come to you. You're the guy that's doing a lot of these. You're the instructor, a lot of times taking the lead instructor role. And in your thought process here, how do you get somebody ready? How do you make sure that an instructor is capable of doing or participating as like a what we will call a line coach or an interior coach or trainer in one of these events?
And if you're working within your area, that's a little bit different than if you go outside your area. Within your area, you kind of know your people or you should know them. One of the things that I look for is an instructor that doesn't have a big ego. You know, he doesn't have to show off. I think that's kind of important, especially in a live fire. He's there for the student, not for himself. And somebody that, and it's kind of hard to put in, you know, quantitative, I guess, is good common sense. Does that instructor have good common sense? Does he have situational awareness? Does he understand what's going on? And that all comes from, you know, being with that instructor on previous burns, possibly, watching him with students or participating while he's going through the live fire training. I think that's real important to have somebody that is not out there to show off. You know, that instructor's got to be there for the students, and he's got to understand that. And if you have an instructor that's not like that, then you probably don't want him teaching students, because that's where we get in trouble, I think, you know.
I just said I'm definitely going to have to agree with you on that. One of the things that I know that's really bad, and I've seen this occur, and I know several instances, is that you get people that want to, you know, be a live fire instructor, and they don't have what I call the true situational awareness of what's going on. And you touched on that, and that is critical. And just to touch on this true situational awareness, it's not just what's going on with the fire, but it's being able to look at your students, know your students, anticipate their reaction, what's going to occur with them, and being able to really have a good control of what's going on. And that's something that a lot of times you get folks in there, and again, you hit this on the head. They're there for themselves and not the students. They're there stroking their egos. And one of the biggest complaints I had as a fire chief, and I hear from fire chiefs around, is when students show up for a live fire training exercise and they come back and their gear is damaged. You know, at that point in time, what did we really teach them? You know, that they can take a lot of heat, or are we teaching them to be inherently dangerous? That fine line that I talk about very frequently between aggressive and reckless. You know, what are we really teaching? So that's important. And I know you had some more comments here, Mike, so jump back in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, your situation awareness as the instructor, you know, heat saturation, that's a big item. You know, how much heat saturation should a student take? And you hit it, you know, where you come back with their gear is burnt or, you know, the helmets are melted and stuff. And that's not really what we want to teach students. It's not how much heat can we take. It's learning about the fire behavior. What is the fire doing? How does it react? And, you know, like I said, with instructors that you work in your area, it's a little easier, I think, than with instructors out of your area. One thing that I did is, and I had it was still in the state of Florida, but it was outside of my area. I had to have that instructor fax a copy of his certification that he was actually a firefighter too, and that he was an instructor before I would allow him to participate in the live fire training class. And, you know, that I'm taking as a state of Florida. He is a state certified firefighter, and he's also an instructor. So to me, that would, you know, kind of qualify him. And then I kind of watch him during the course and see if he really is paying attention. You know, if he's not, I'm going to pull him aside, talk to him a little bit, you know, and go from there.
Well, I think that's a very relevant way of approaching it. And we truly have to be cognizant of the legal aspects when it comes to this. When you start doing live fire, and especially even in a training event, you are dealing with what we deal with on a daily basis. Even though it's in a controlled environment, quote unquote, specifically here we'll talk in this program about gas-fired and non-gas-fired. And most of these are either metal or concrete structures. The potential for failure typically is very, very minimal. The chance of a lot of flashovers occurring are very minimal. But yet, we know that we've had injuries, and we know that we've had even one recorded fatality in a burn building. So we know that it can potentially happen. So that level of experience, that level of abilities as an instructor to be able to control and deliver education is critical. So let's kind of take a look here at those cases. And let's talk a little bit. And Dave, I know that you've researched this a lot, especially when it comes to the book. You know, what's happening when we're taking these people to burn facilities and starting to burn, when we're starting to see near misses and when we're having injuries? Let's talk a little bit about what we know is our past history, chapter one of the book. How did we get to where we're at?
Well, you know, one of the things in researching for the book, I interviewed David Wall, who's Georgia Fire Academy's director. And he brought up a really very good observation that's so pertinent to what Mike was just saying and actually what Susan and you were discussing before that. And that is, what are we trying to do with the students in there? You're trying to get specific goals for them to see fire behavior, see how it's going to react to application of water, all of those good attributes that we all say we know and we want to do. But if the student's going in there is just scared half to death, what are they going to be learning? They're in survival mode. So, you know, tying back into what we've just discussed, you have to have a plan, and the plan's got to be not to see how tough they are, not to be a rookie roast or anything like that. It's got to be a definitive plan, and if it doesn't burn like a real fire, that can be okay too, as long as you build them into making sure how you do it is going to reflect how they're going to react and how they're going to operate in real life. And that's what you have to keep your concentration on. If you go through the past incidents, you see where that's not happened. If you've been teaching for a length of time, unfortunately, you've probably been there and seen it happen where it looks like it's getting away from what the plan was, whether it be a gas prop, a Class A prop, or even acquired props or buildings. You see where you lose the focus of what you're trying to get done. And hopefully what you're trying to get done is just what Susan said. You start off incrementally, build up their comfort and confidence level, and keep them working like they're going to have to do it for real.
Well, that's a very good place to kind of put us at a pausing point. We're about halfway through the show. We need to stop and take a break. When we come back, we're going to really dive into what it takes to put on a quality, compliant live fire training program with these great folks that have taught a lot of live fire and are considered quote unquote the experts in the business as they're putting out kind of the first book that's been written truly about how to conduct live fire training. So let's pause and take a break. You're listening to Training and Tactics Talk. We'll be back right after this.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. Joining me is Dave Casey, Susan Schell, and Mike Kemp. They're both folks that have worked in live fire training for quite some time, and our show today is focusing in on, you know, getting good quality training out of our live fire evolutions. And we're going to focus in on this program. We started out and we told you we were going to talk about gas-fired, non-gas-fired props, which is going to be our fixed facilities. We kind of brought you up to a point of what students should be doing, what instructors' levels should be at, where we should be at totally with getting to where we're teaching and how we should be teaching and some of the philosophies. So at this point in time, I want to start by walking through what it takes to really have a compliant live fire training exercise. So I'm just going to kind of go around the horn, and I'm going to start off by saying that it's important, first of all, to understand your facility. Susan talked a little bit about that. If you have a gas-fired facility, you have to be trained by the manufacturer on how to use that particular device or devices that are installed in that facility. You need to understand truly the safety mechanisms that are built in and why they're built in, how they operate and why they operate the way they do. Understanding, you know, every time you burn, there is some degradation to the props, making sure that you understand truly how to inspect your building. And your building, there is a schedule on that, and a lot of people don't recognize that or don't realize that there is, you know, a time period. And for structure evaluation, it's supposed to be conducted once per year for live fire training structures that support more than 60 days of live fire training. Now, that's quite a bit of burning, you know, for a lot of places, but for some places, you know, it's not uncommon for them to have 150 days of live fire training, as we saw in Connecticut. So it's important. And once every 2 years, that live fire training structure that supports 31 days to 61 days of live fire training, you know, needs to be doing a good quality inspection. And, of course, you know, if it's fewer than 30, you know, the time frame, you know, jumps out to 3 years. But let's face it, anytime you get ready to burn in that facility, it needs to be looked at. It needs to be eyeballed. It needs to have, you know, a look at the systems. All your systems need to be checked. And it's just like counting down for a launch of the space shuttle, in a sense, is that we walk through checklists to make certain things, you know, are covered. We want to make sure that everything is a go. And we'll talk about that go sequence, a go or no-go sequence, you know, as we get kind of towards the end. And I know that that's Mike's thunder, so I'm not going to steal it. But, Susan, I know that being in a training facility like you are, let's talk about getting ready for the evolution. What has to start to occur in the very beginning phases to get everything rolling, to get us started?
If the beginning is actually to get an IAP, a good instant action plan, sit down and start to think about this, because that's where you need to begin. That's going to tell you where your resources are. And if you're at a facility such as mine, where you're at your facility all the time, you probably already have a book of procedures together. If not, it's good to have a book of procedures and have those checklists like you were talking about, Doug, in a three-ring binder, so that when it is time to go do that visual inspection of your building, you pull that three-ring binder out and you go to the building and you go write down your checklist. And then you also will have one that is, if the gas fired, the checklist as the actual steps you have to go by step, because as we all know, you have to run that system prior to your live burn to make sure that's going. So those checklists are a valuable part. If you have your prepared plot plans with your where your water supplies are laid out, those are templates that are already designed that are probably at everybody's facility. You have your burn building already laid out as to floors. You have plot plans, elevation plans. Those are all usually in a textbook that we have. You also have your accountability board, because that's a very good, important part of live burn, is to assure your accountability, as well as checklist of equipment, just making sure that you have the right hose loads, that you have the right appliances. If you're going to, how many engines are you going to need? It's we get into a whole lot of with water supply, of course, and understanding that you may be able to use a single source if your facility is designed that way. Those are all things that are outlined in 1403, but I can't tell you how much just having those checklists in a book and a three-ring binder that you can pull that out. And a good IAP addresses all this, that if you've, once you've come up with that template, that gives you your jumping ground to do all these burns. So that's a good place is where I start with my IAP and my checklist for my logistics and checklist for all the different notifications that we have to do. And that pretty much including, and like I said, then you'll have your helicopter landing zones established and all that ready for you to go. So that's a majority of it right there. And, of course, as we already talked, there's a checklist then as well to make sure that your students have met their prerequisites, and reminding us to do our gear checks and all of our instructor assignments as well.
That's important, those checklists. One of the things that you just hit on that's super important is that the students truly meet the requirements. Part of what I've got in a form and have used for some time is if these students are coming from another organization, say, to participate in a live fire training exercise that's being conducted, say, by my volunteer department, Ruffin Fire Department. Well, if they're coming from another department, I have a form that they have to have signed by the chief or the training officer stating that they meet all the criteria. And if they don't have that, they can't participate, because that then puts the liability back to the authority having jurisdiction saying that they've had the training. That's one of the ways that you need to do that. Also, with moving on from the prerequisites of the students, one of the things that we want to make sure, and is that's probably in a checklist on your IEP that was being talked about by Susan, but making sure all these doors and windows and everything operates appropriately and it works the way it's supposed to work. It doesn't get hung up. It doesn't get, you know, where it won't open or only partially opens. If they're designed for a specific way, then that's the way that they need to be operable. So, Dave, let's kind of pick up from there. We've got our IEP. We've got everything. Let's go from there.
Well, once you have your plan, and it's like Susan said, if you're in a permanent prop, you should be able to have these pretty much laid out. I mean, you're going to have to change the objectives for your group. You have to look, of course, at weather conditions for that day and any differences from your normal operations. I mean, you don't do everything cookie cutter, because obviously you have different groups go through. You have to look at who is the audience, who's the group that's coming through. Do we have a rookie class, or do we have veterans, or are we doing a company officer? You have to look at all that. And once we've got our plan together, then we have the activities of the day. We have to go through and do a thorough walkthrough on the building, make sure we do look for foreign objects on the ground, do an FOD search through there. We have to make sure all of our doors and windows work okay, that there's no debris or nothing mechanical interfering with their operation, and do our 360 around the whole place. And, of course, if it's a gas prop, you have to go through exactly what the manufacturer says. Try everything out. Make sure all the safety equipment's working. Make sure you're 100% ready to go. And back to that checklist that we mentioned, the day of the event, you know, you've got it all planned, but you need to make sure you use that plan, and you may have to make sure you make the contacts that are in that plan, whether it be for the EMS provider, if it's not your own agency. Some places still have to notify the environmental folks, and go through your checklist. But the biggest thing is you've made a good plan, hopefully. You need to follow that plan, because that's one of the things we found in looking back at a lot of the injury and fatality incidents. It wasn't the original plan that got people in trouble. It was deviating from the plans that did them in.
And that's a very key point there, so I want to point it out. It's not the original plan that got folks in trouble. It's when they start deviating, and we will call that freelancing, because that's exactly what it is they begin freelancing off of what the original plan was. So to move us along a little further here, we talked about all this prerequisite stuff that we need to do. We've done inspections. We're testing our products that we have there, especially if it's gas, to make sure all the safety facilities, all the those devices work. Another thing we got to think about is how this is going to impact the community, as far as is it going to, you know, cause problems with, you know, a highway, a street? Does it affect a neighborhood? You know, are we aware of our weather conditions? You know, the wind velocity, you know, anything that can affect us, we need to be thinking about it. So let's jump to the instructor in charge here. And, Mike, I'm going to turn to you. We're going to set up. We're actually going to start putting the key elements together here with our apparatus, our lines. Let's talk about water supply. Go ahead and jump in here, and this is kind of the area that you really like, and I watched you work. So let's see and show these people what we need to be doing.
Okay. Let me jump back to the IAP, the Incident Action Plan. Everybody needs to look at that and understand it. And the other thing that needs to go on, Susan touched on it briefly, is a landing zone. Put GPS coordinates on there. Make sure that you have that. Just don't have a general location. Have a GPS coordinate so that if you need somebody to tomahawk them out and burn or whatever, they know exactly where they're coming in, pick the person up, wherever that may be. The other thing is emergency number. You know, Dave touched on that. Write that on that incident action plan. Don't leave it up to somebody with a, you know, portable phone or whatever that's in their phone to call. Make sure it's on the plan itself. And then when we talked about the deviating from the plan, what is the objective? It's clearly written on that plan, and everybody understands it. The other thing, students should walk through the building and then have the instructor walk through the building. Do a dry run if need be, which is not a bad idea. You know, don't flow any water yet. And do a dry run, just so everybody understands where we're going, how we're going to attack the fire, we're going to back out, and whatever else that may be. Once you actually get ready to light the fire, everybody's ready, and we're going to do a go, no-go sequence. And I do that. You know, the space shuttle does it. You know, they do a go, no-go sequence, and anybody in that sequence can stop that process, and then you would start all over again. What I like to do is start from the farthest away from where the ignition is going to occur or the fire set up to the ignition. And that might be you start at rehab. Make sure that you have somebody in rehab. They have the equipment they need. Then you would move to the engines. Make sure they have the water flowing. Engine pressures are set. They have a good water supply. Then move up, you know, to your RIT crew, your backup line, attack line, and then all the way up to the ignition. And then the safety officer would be the last person that would go a go. And it would just be a simple all instructor stand by for a go, no go sequence. You would call each position and they would either say go or no go. If it's a go, you just move into the next position and ask them for a go, no go. They would give that to you. If you have a go, no go, go all the way through, you would tell, you know, after the safety says a go, you would have a go for ignition. Then you would have the ignition officer or whoever's igniting with, in the presence of the safety officer, because that's what 1403 says, and preferably with a hose line, that they would ignite the fire, then say, we have ignition, so that it can be documented on your incident action plan. What time did you actually light the fire? That gives you a good clue of how long people are on air, and you can start counting down, you know, your 30-minute bottles, 45-minute bottles, and how long they're actually working. And from that point on, it's just watching everybody, making sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing. And at any time something happens, somebody could stop that once again, and then you would start that sequence all over again.
And that's very important. And I'm going to jump to something here that we haven't touched upon, but is something that should be in your incident action plan to begin with, going back to that IEP, and that's your water supply. And it's very important that you understand that NFPA 1142, the standard on water supplies, you know, when it talks about firefighting in suburban and rural firefighting settings, it lays out what you need. And you also have to realize that, you know, with your water supply, you need a 50% additional fire flow demand. And that's, you know, if something goes wrong, you need that. So if you need 1,000 gallons, then you need 500 gallons extra, you know, for you, you know, that additional reserve. And we need to be thinking about something here. Since we're at a fixed facility, one of the things that I want to bring out is that a single water source can be used as long as it's sufficient for that training facility. And notice the key word there, sufficient. But it also has to be engineered so that it is powered with a backup power source. It will flow that adequate volume for the evolution and attach it to that backup power source or backup pumps or both. And that has to be in place to ensure that an uninterrupted supply of water is going to be there in the event that we have a power failure or malfunction, because that's what's, you know, truly supplying a lot of your systems or your hydrants there. If you have a city municipal water source, then what we have is that you have to have two water sources that comes into play, where you have your hydrants that's being supplied there, but you also have to have a second water source that's adequate with that reserve component, you know, in place. Because for what we're indicating here, you're setting your hose lines up. Your initial attack line and your backup line have to come off of separate water sources, correct?
Yes.
And
that's very important.
That's very important. One of the places that I see, and we see this happen from time to time when we're out on live fires, is that the attack line and the backup line will come off of the same engine. Well, that's okay as long as you've got that fixed facility. It's a single water source, but it met all that criteria we just talked about. I'm a proponent, let's be safe all the time. So let's have that backup line coming off of a secondary water source so that if something goes wrong, it's instantaneous and we've got another source of water. We're not lost. One of the fallacies that people use is, oh, my safety line is on a different water source. Well, if you want to have three water sources, that's great. But that backup line, and that's specific in the standard, that the backup line needs to come off that secondary or separate water source. So that's an important part. Well, Dave, let's go back to you. Go ahead, Mike. I think you wanted to add something in there.
Yeah, I just want to say I think some instructors forget about that, that they forget that that backup line is there to protect the attack line crew and that personnel. You know, they're not really there to put fire out most of the time. They're there to protect that personnel. And if they're on the same water source and that engine quits, they have no water. You know, in a fixed facility, it's not too bad, but you could have, you know, heat saturation pretty quick. One of the things we forget about as instructors is a continuous burn over and over again. That building is continuously heating up. We need to think about letting that building cool down every once in a while so that as we burn, it doesn't impact us as much or as quickly because of heat saturation and radiated feedback.
And that's very, very true. And I hope that people that are listening to our program are taking heed to that, is that we have a tendency to go in and go in and go in and go in and never cool the building down. We ventilate structures when we're on regular working incidents. Why would we not cool the building back down itself to prevent, you know, any type of problem occurring? So that's important as well. Well, I'm going to go back to you, Dave, and let's talk a little bit about our fuel materials. And I definitely, you know, when we have a gas-fired facility, we know that that's going to be by manufactured, you know, specs for the system that we have in place. But I really want to talk about our Class A buildings and what we're burning in those buildings. So jump in here and let's talk about the fuel materials that's in NFPA 1403.
Well, 1403 gives you some general guidelines of what to use. And one of the biggest things it you see repeated throughout there is materials with known burning characteristics. And how the fire service has really evolved because of some of the fires, both in acquired and even in some of the permanent props, some of the materials that's been used, is really going toward making sure you're using clean pallets and known wood products. You know, by known wood products, where you've got sometimes access to places that make pallets or other wood products. I know near the Florida Fire College, they have several manufacturers of pallets, and they also have some real large lumber yards, not lumber yards, but where they cut the lumber down from the actual fallen trees. So you can get a lot of knockoffs and dried material, so you know how that's going to react. And all of that is great products, along with Excelsior or hay or straw that you know is organic. It doesn't have pesticides or other materials on it. One of the things that people lose sight of frequently in using the permanent Class A props, whether they be metal buildings, concrete, or even the connexes, is how much fuel you're putting in there and what damage that's going to do. If you go back to the old concrete burn buildings that most of us grew up on and most of us still have access to, the very long tried and true type buildings, a lot of them have been damaged to a point they can't be used anymore because of just too much fuel loading. And you have to specify, if you're the program manager there, you have to specify how much will be used. And some facilities are getting pretty ingenious by using cribs and other materials that or other types of hearths and such that only allow a certain amount of material in there. Susan got us a great picture for the book from one of her compadres in Maryland at a facility that we won't throw under the bus here, but the policy was you will not use more than 3 pallets and half a bale of hay. And one of the instructors there got a great picture of about 7 or 8 pallets. And I can't tell how many bales of hay. It was a lot. And it was just a matter of, in the plan, you say how much you're going to use. You're very specific how you're going to reload it, when you're going to reload it, who's going to do it, and under what conditions. And you have to enforce it. And it's hard, especially at regional schools where you have different departments using it. You have to have basically someone that's in charge from the facility to watch over that and make sure that the materials that that facility says you will use are, in fact, what's used and in the right quantities. You know, there's a lot of things you can do. There's a lot of schools that say they're going to want to use wooden furniture and other products in there, and that's rooms for a great debate there. But in a nutshell for today, you know, let's say you have to specify, if you're the boss of the building, you have to specify what's going to be used in it and how much. And, again, you got to enforce it.
One of the things about fuels, too, and this is in the standard under 6.3.6, and it gives an exception, and it's talking about, again, with our gas-fired props, but the use of flammable or combustible liquids as defined in NFPA 30 are not to be used in these live fire training evolutions. So, and that happens frequently. And, you know, there are specific cases out there where we've seen, you know, instructors that have been hurt, students that have been hurt, instructors and students both that have been killed. So that's important that's thrown out there, especially for live fire. Even though we're talking about in burn facilities, it's important that we really understand what's in the standard. Susan, I'm going to jump over to you. We're going to talk a little bit about safety, and one of the components that I think that we really need to understand in that is the physiology about our bodies and how it reacts to what we're doing for the evolution, and that leads us into the talk about rehab and those type of things. So let's get you involved here, and this is an area that I know you're passionate on, so let that passion flow.
Well, I'm sure most of your listeners, as we all watch and the line of duty deaths, and just recently we've had people who have participated in training exercises. One was a roof ventilation, went home not feeling well, and was found dead by his family later. Again, we realize that we're losing heart attacks, and in training, heart attacks is one of those killers of our firefighters during training. So physiology is very important that the instructors understand heat stress, cold stress, and the effects of cold up north. You've got to, first of all, know where your students are physically, and you should be talking about fitness with them and making sure that they have the cardiac fitness and the strength and that you know where their levels are and not push them beyond those levels, because you can get very bad results. We know that our gear encapsulates us so that we can't get that sweating evaporation we used to get. Instead, it stays underneath our gear, and we start to develop heat stress. So even though we may not be actively doing anything, just the fact that we're standing around with our gear all the way closed, our bodies are not able to breathe. We're not allowed to get that core temperature down where it needs to be. And so we need to know and understand the physiology of heat and how our body deals with heat and what happens to our core temperature. Rehab is very important. That's why there's guidelines on, you know, maximum of two bottles, and that's two 30-minute bottles. And then they've got to go to mandatory rehab. On hotter days, you need to increase that rehab amount. And during rehab, you've got to get them out of that heat, relief from the environment, rehydrate them, get those fluids going, and not just an 8-ounce bottle of water, but a quart and a couple quarts of water to replace that fluid levels. They have to have some medical monitoring going on. And a lot of problems don't have a baseline to begin with or some area to start with. You don't know when they come back out if they're dealing well with this or if their body is or is not. So it's important to watch their vital signs too. But more importantly is know the participants. And, you know, we go back to, for years, our firefighters, nobody's ever going to say, hey, coach, I feel bad, take me out. You just don't do it. A firefighter is not going to say, I feel bad, I don't want to go back in, because we know they're going to be ribbed to death. So they'll tell you they're perfectly fine. That's when you need to look at them and say, no, you're not. And rehab needs to say, no, you're not fine. You need to sit out more and let your body recover. And very importantly, that we're stressing now more and more, and you see it in the near-miss reports and in Billy Goldfeder's documentation. If they're feeling bad when they come back from training, don't send them home and forget about them thinking they're going to sleep it off. If they're feeling bad, make sure you follow up. Call them in an hour. Go make sure they're awake, because we don't want to lose someone after training because we've left them go and they may suffer a heart attack or a heat-related illness later. And the heat does affect the cardiac. So it's very important that we stress that safety component so we don't lose people in training. And the instructors not only have to notify or watch their students and know these signs, but the instructors have to stop back too and lead by example. That's one of those instructor qualifications that we didn't talk about, was leading by example. I can't send someone to rehab and force them to go to rehab if I'm going to stay there and go through burns and burns and say, I'm the instructor, I don't have to go to rehab. So we've got to rehab ourselves and know that if we're not feeling well, it's time for us to say, I need to set out, because we have lost instructors in live fire training as well.
And that is very true. There was an instructor that wasn't necessarily involved in the actual burning component, but in another portion of an evolution, you know, this about a year or so ago in North Carolina, and it resulted in him having a heart attack as well. So it's important that we recognize that hydration is a key. We need to be hydrated when we come, and we need to maintain our hydration, you know, while we're on the scene. And I'll talk a little bit to bring it home here with that rehab. I did a burn down on the coast of North Carolina, and the group that was doing rehab was absolutely wonderful. In fact, it is the best rehab I think I've ever been through. When I came out, I was literally attacked, is how I describe it. I mean, they made sure that, you know, my gear was, you know, my coat was off, the hood was off, that I dropped, you know, the bunker pants down over the boots to allow for cooling. You know, I had, you know, tympanic thermometers in my ear. I had pulse oxes on. They were monitoring CO in the bloodstream. They were doing all these type of components. And, of course, you had your blood pressures. You had your pulses being done. And the first thing they handed me was two water bottles to drink. And then they sent me down in the chair. It was a cooling chair that you put your forearms in. And it was just an awesome experience to go through a rehab like that. That, you know, typically we don't see that. A lot of times, well, we'll go over here, we'll, you know, we'll get somebody to check her blood pressure, we'll check her pulse, and yeah, we'll sit here for a few minutes, we'll drink some water, and then we'll go back to work. But, you know, they were actually pulling folks, and they pulled an instructor after his first burn because his blood pressure wouldn't come back down, and they were very adamant, you're done. And nobody got out of that place, you know, of their control until they said they were capable of going back. So I commend those folks for their abilities on what they did. So let's kind of wrap up here, and I want to talk a little bit about the ratios of our instructors and our students to end this here to make sure that we are hitting on some safety. It's important to understand that when we're putting an instructor ratio together, that there should be an instructor for each functional crew, and it should be no more than 5 students to that one instructor. And we use that 5-to-1 ratio in command as the optimum. We're going to use it here as, you know, it's not to exceed those 5 students when we're in a functional crew. Now, functional crew could be the attack line, it could be the backup line, it could be the safety line, rapid intervention, ventilation, anything that's going on, that functional position or that functional team needs to have an instructor with them. For whatever that assignment may be, they need to be there. And if additional safety personnel or instructors are deemed necessary by a safety officer, then they strategically need to be located. And one of the things I think about is having multiple interior safety people, multiple exterior safety people, and an instructor or a safety instructor that's looking over all of that in place. And it's imperative that we put our best foot forward to maintain, you know, a safe operation, to make it a compliant operation, and that we follow the plan. And one of the last things I want to touch on here, we've mentioned objectives. You need to have sound objectives that meet the student capability. And we said that in the beginning, and I want to say it at the very end, that our students are there to learn. Their students are there to build their skills, their abilities to function, to get to what we call a realism level, or to where they have true situational awareness about what's going on. And that's that effective level of learning that we're after. So we need to keep that in our minds, and that needs to be paramount in every one of our operations. As we're closing here, Dave, do you have any final comments you would like to make?
Well, I think just, sounds like a commercial, but I really think the ISFSI program is going to be something that can bring a lot of assistance to the fire departments throughout the U.S. and Canada. I mean, there's very few places you can go and get a credential that is backed up and that has the content like that. And I think it'll be a good program.
Mike, how about you? Anything to add to the final comments here?
Let me go back to Dave's pallets. Is that, you know, there are a bunch of different size pallets. What we look at as a pallet is about, you know, 40 inches, 36 inches square, somewhere around there. It's not some of these pallets that are 8 feet long and 4 foot wide. You know, it's a common size pallet so that you know the BTUs that are being given off. The other thing is that, you know, known burn characteristics, and that's one of the big things. We have several instructors in Florida that think that, you know, polyurethane, they know the burning characteristics of polyurethane, you know, that it burns a lot hotter. Well, it does. You know, it's anywhere from, you know, 24,000 to 145,000. Well, that's not known. It depends on the density of it, what it is, or anything else. Well, wood, you know, it's not going to give off pretty much any more than the BTUs. So that's a known characteristic. And back to your student instructor ratio, the important thing is also that all instructors have a radio. If you look at Baltimore, Maryland, that was one of the violations, that you had instructors with crews, with students, and they had no means of communication. You know, I can't even fathom doing a burn if the instructors don't have radios, let alone, you know, the students probably have them also. You know, we're our own worst enemy sometimes. We need to make it safe. We're the ones that are out there doing the job.
Okay, Susan, anything you want to wrap up with?
Very quickly, 1403 is there to assure that we do safely and do the live burn safely. It's not there. You hear a lot of comments that it's there to keep us from burning. It's not. It's there to ensure that both of our students are done and our training are safe and our instructors go home, and that we reduce the number of injuries and deaths. That's what it's there for, and it's an excellent resource. And I second Dave's that this is a good, ISFSI has a great program out there that is a great resource and has a great, just a very good overall on 1403 to give you those objectives. But if you follow that 1403 during your live burn, it's a beneficial burn, and your students are going to learn.
Well, I'll echo an amen to all of that. It's exactly correct. Our goal is to make things the safest they can be with the best education possible that's going to lead to effective learning down the road, to where students are going to be better at what they do and be safer and have the knowledge to be safer. Well, I certainly appreciate the three of you joining me on Training and Tactics Talk. In the future, we want to talk about acquired structures. We want to talk more about this subject because this is a very important subject when it comes to training. This is what we do in the field a lot of times. But we also know that our fires are down. And where do we get our experience level? But through good quality training, because that's going to produce quality education in that cue decision-making process that we need when we get to the field, and we've got to make decisions, and especially at the officer level. Well, we thank you as our listeners for tuning in to Training and Tactics Talk. As always, our goal is to make sure that and ensure through our training that everyone goes home. Stay tuned, and we look forward to having you on a future Training and Tactics Talk. And remember, train hard, stay safe, because some things are more important. And remember, every time you're out, it's the family at home that are the unsung heroes. And in the words of our National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, everyone goes home.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.